Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, who is accused of sexual misconduct with four women. You'll get information on the relocation of the Crown Point BMV. Jill Sheridan reports on diabetes rates in Indiana. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Spiros Batistados from the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Updates. The Crown Point branch of the Indiana Bureau of Motor Vehicles office is relocating to 1244 Main Street. The move to the former Broncos restaurant location was announced Thursday. The branch, currently located at 1430 East Joliet Street, will continue to serve customers through Saturday. In addition to the relocation, the branch will have a new 24-hour BMV Connect kiosk beginning next Wednesday. Connect is a new concept in customer service which gives Indiana residents the option to visit a BMV branch any time of the day to complete routine transactions. For a complete list of branch locations and hours, to complete an online transaction, or to find a 24-hour BMV Connect kiosk near you, please visit in.gov/BMV. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry asked the court Tuesday to appoint a special prosecutor to handle any issues related to sexual misconduct allegations against Attorney General Curtis Hill. The court granted that request and will appoint someone in the coming weeks. Curry says the need for a special prosecutor is simple. He is a client of the Attorney General's office.
By law, the Attorney General is required to represent any prosecutor who has been sued in a civil action.
A special prosecutor would consult with the investigating agency and determine whether to bring charges. The investigating agency in this case is the Indiana Inspector General, with whom Curry says he's spoken.
I have facilitated contact between the Inspector General's office and Sex Crimes Unit of Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, should the Inspector General seek the assistance of IMPD in her investigation.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. An Indiana legislative staffer on Thursday became the third woman and the first Republican to publicly accuse State Attorney General Curtis Hill of groping her at a party in March, saying the Republican office holder slid his hand down her back and touched her buttocks when she reached to push his hand away. Nikki DeSilva is a legislative assistant for the Indiana Senate Republican Caucus. She writes in her account in the Indianapolis Star that she is the employee A mentioned in an internal legislative memo leaked to media outlets that describes Hill's alleged drunken groping of four women at an Indianapolis bar. DeSilva wrote that the allegations that Hill groped her, two other legislative staffers, and a state lawmaker early on March 15th at a bar party celebrating the end of the legislative session are serious. She says, quote, Hill has repeatedly denied the allegations and has defiantly rebuffed calls for him to resign. Governor Eric Holcomb and Senate GOP leaders last week called on Hill to resign, and Indiana's Inspector General Lori Torres is investigating the claims. A special prosecutor will review the findings to determine whether Hill will face criminal charges. Two Democrats, State Rep. Mara Candelaria Reardon and Gabrielle McLemore, the Indiana Senate Democrats' communications director, came forward last week and accused Hill of inappropriately touching them at the party. DeSilva said that after Candelaria Reardon told her May 15th that she had filed a complaint with the Indiana House Speaker about Hill's alleged groping of her, she was interviewed by the Senate Republican Caucus. She said she eventually learned that, quote, the inappropriate and inexcusable behaviors exhibited by Attorney General Hill were experienced by multiple women of both political parties from both chambers and in varying positions within the legislature. She goes on to say, quote, individually, our stories may cause doubt in some minds. However, when these stories are weaved together, they stand as a strong testament to a deliberate pattern of unacceptable behavior. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Attorney General Curtis Hill says it appears the latest accusation that he groped a woman at a party in March was, quote, coordinated and changed under the direction of others. Hill made the assertion in a statement released after a third woman publicly accused him of groping her. Nikki DeSilva, a legislative assistant for the Indiana Senate Republican Caucus, says in an account in the Indianapolis Star that Hill slid his hand down her back. When she tried to push it away, she says he grabbed her hand and moved both their hands over her buttocks, lingering there before letting go. Hill says DeSilva asked for help in preparing a statement accusing him of misconduct. He contends she asked a close friend for input on whether there were grammatical errors or phrases that needed to be, quote, changed, strengthened, or eliminated. Hill says the integrity of the investigation of his behavior has been compromised, adding DeSilva's emails with others should be preserved. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. An autopsy has determined that a 3-year-old girl who was found unresponsive in a northwest Indiana pond drowned. The Times reports that the Porter County coroner released Tamara Billingsley's cause of death Wednesday. A police dog found the child in the pond Monday night after authorities in Valparaiso responded to a call about a missing girl. She later was pronounced dead at a hospital. Tamara's mother, 32-year-old Tasia Perkins, has been charged with neglect. The girl's death remains under investigation. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. BP says a $300 million project that will reduce sulfur levels in gasoline made at its sprawling Whiting refinery could create up to 500 construction jobs. The company says about 250 workers are working to install a naphtha hydrotreater at its Whiting refinery to meet a new U.S. EPA mandate to make gasoline cleaner. The Times reports that mandate requires gas to contain less than 10 parts per million of sulfur. The current standard is 30 parts per million. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court has many eyes turning in Indiana. Democratic incumbent Joe Donnelly is a key vote in the Senate. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on local reaction to Kavanaugh's nomination.
Senator Joe Donnelly's statement says only that he'll carefully review Brett Kavanaugh's record and qualifications. Republican Senator Todd Young is more direct. He praises Kavanaugh as a, quote, originalist.
Someone who wants to apply the Constitution as written as opposed to reading into it things that aren't there.
Young won't say whether he wants the landmark abortion rights case Roe v. Wade overturned, but Planned Parenthood advocates Christy Gillespie says abortion rights and affordable health care are at stake.
Hoosiers should be concerned about that and should actively express their concerns to their elected officials.
Gillespie says if Kavanaugh shows a willingness to rule against those issues, Planned Parenthood advocates and its supporters expect Joe Donnelly to vote against the nomination. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Elkhart and St. Joseph County Planned Parenthood facilities may see an increase in patients from Northeast Indiana after the Fort Wayne office closed its doors earlier this week amid allegations of harassment from pro-life groups in the area. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Aguiano has more.
A notice on the main entrance of the Fort Wayne Planned Parenthood office, set to be vacant on July 31st, directs visitors to Elkhart and Mishawaka facilities. Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky President and CEO Christy Gillespie says she thinks the impact of closing the facility in Fort Wayne is lost to the public.
So it just creates an environment that is unfortunate because this closing in Fort Wayne isn't going to shut Planned Parenthood down statewide, but it's all about the patient.
She says one of the main reasons Planned Parenthood spoke out about why the Fort Wayne facility would close was to make the alleged harassment and intimidation Planned Parenthood facilities sometimes face known. Gillespie says the Elkhart offices have been notified about a potential wave of new patients and says other Planned Parenthood locations can also be found online. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. President Donald Trump has nominated a Northern Indiana agribusinessman to be the nation's next ambassador of agriculture to the United Nations. If the U.S. Senate confirms Kip Thom for the post, he would be based in Rome and oversee three U.N. agencies based there. His title would be U.S. Representative to the U.N. Agencies for Food and Agriculture. Thom is Chief Executive Officer of Thom Farms, which is based in the Kosciuszko town of Leesburg and grows corn and soybeans in seven northern Indiana counties. The Journal Gazette reports, Thom says in an email, quote, that he looks forward to representing the administration and our country if confirmed. Thom ran unsuccessfully in the 2016 Republican primary election for northeastern Indiana's 3rd District, losing to eventual U.S. Rep. Jim Banks. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Emotions ran high for local veteran customers at Wednesday's Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission hearing. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Isaiah Siebert was there.
An unidentified man was escorted out of the auditorium after he rushed the podium.
This is a hostage situation.
I don't think it's particularly productive to rush the stage.
Desperate people taking desperate measures. Wendy Breadhold with the Sierra Club calls it a ratepayer rebellion.
But I think that when you hear from people and people speaking on the behalf of those who are really struggling, these are things that are fraught with emotion.
Vectren wants to build a nearly $800 million natural gas plant in Posey County. It would replace 4 coal units. A 5th coal unit would be updated for an additional $95 million. The company would recoup the cost through higher rates. Many people at the hearing spoke against the plans, but some did support the company, including the president and CEO of an organization that receives funding from Vectren. No decision was made at the hearing. That'll come in a few months. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Isaiah Siebert.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. State officials have begun developing a financial indicators monitoring program for all public schools in Indiana in the hope of eliminating the need for more takeovers of financially distressed units such as the current status of the Gary Community School Corp. House and Road Act 1315, which was approved in May, established the Indiana Fiscal and Qualitative Indicators Committee to initially identify which data should be used to evaluate a school district's financial status and then develop a quote dashboard website for Hoosiers to see where their schools stand. The 7-member committee is led by Courtney Schaffsma, Executive Director of the Indiana Distressed Unit Appeals Board. Last year, the DUAB appointed and currently oversees the emergency manager running Gary Schools under a 2017 law unseating the local school board after it repeatedly failed to balance the district budget and racked up more than $100 million in debt. Schaffsma told the School Board of Education Wednesday that the Indicators Committee is just getting started with figuring out which factors should be considered signs of potential school corporation financial distress. Schaffma goes on to say the committee is hoping to prepare a draft indicators plan by August 23rd. A public hearing on the plan tentatively is scheduled for September 6th, with the final plan set for adoption September 27th. The State Budget Committee must review the proposed financial indicators, likely in October, before the dashboard is launched. School districts that appear to be in financial trouble will undergo a board assessment for distress. DUAB can then require a struggling school corporation to implement a corrective action plan. Under the law, districts that fail to adopt or follow the corrective action plan will go on a, quote, watch list for a possible action by the administration or General Assembly.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Schools now have more guidance from the state around new graduation pathway requirements. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports, educators and school leaders have stressed the importance of locally created options for districts.
When the State Board of Education approved new graduation requirements last year, educators shared a lot of concerns. Many questioned how they could make the new standards work in vastly different schools for every student. This month, the board approved a guide to clarify different parts of those standards. Board member Byron Ernest says now schools can use that to shape their plans moving forward.
Now it's just a matter of, in all cases, those schools, communities coming together and really answering the question, what can we create together?
The new graduation requirements go into effect in 2019. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The state says it's confirmed the first death in Indiana associated with a multi-state hepatitis A outbreak. The Indiana State Department of Health isn't releasing any more information about the death, citing privacy laws. While Indiana typically sees about 20 cases a year, there are 214 Hep A cases in the state associated with the outbreak. 7 counties are affected so far. Deputy Health Commissioner Pam Partonis says they're working closely with local health departments
to educate the public, restaurants, jails, groups that serve at-risk populations about this outbreak and ways to prevent the disease.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Rocker and Hoosier native John Mellencamp has been awarded the Woody Guthrie Prize. The Woody Guthrie Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, announced Wednesday that Mellencamp will be presented with the award during an August 30th ceremony. He is the 5th recipient. The annual prize is given to an artist who best exemplifies the spirit and life work of Woody Guthrie by speaking for the less fortunate and serving as a positive force for social change. The center says in a news release that Mellencamp, like Guthrie, quote, has used his artistic gifts to spread a positive message of hope, equality, and freedom. Mellencamp is an Indiana native and a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. His latest album, Sad Clowns and Hillbillies, includes the song My Soul's Got Wings, with lyrics written by Guthrie and music by Mellencamp. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A city's layout, neighborhood by neighborhood, access to health care, outdoor recreation, and healthy food can have a significant health impact. This is evident in Indiana, where some neighborhood diabetes rates reflect these factors. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on a $7 million diabetes impact pilot that may serve as a model for communities across the state.
Diabetes is something 69-year-old Alma Trawick knows a lot about.
You can lose your legs, you lose your eyesight. I mean, you know, my mom was a double amputee. She didn't have no legs.
Trawick lives in Indianapolis's Keystone Millersville neighborhood on the near northeast side. Her brother also has the disease. She was diagnosed as type 2 last year.
So when I was 68, and I know why I went over that line, because I stopped exercising and stopped eating right.
She's taken diabetes education classes at her neighborhood YMCA. She gets on the treadmill when she can, but when it comes to food, she says for many in this neighborhood, what's affordable and available often wins out.
We've got Popeye's Chicken, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's. We have Taco Bell, Long John Silver. We have 2 other chicken places just on 38th Street in Keystone.
An estimated 11% of Hoosiers live with diabetes. In Trawick's neighborhood, the percentage of diagnosed cases is closer to 17%. It's one of 3 Indianapolis neighborhoods that will have dedicated health workers through a new diabetes reduction pilot, one that could be extended to other neighborhoods in the state.
We need to make people aware of it. And so it's like, oh my God, I'm a diabetic. You know, it's like the bad thing.
Residents like Trawick will encourage neighbors to engage with the program. IU Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI is one of 5 partners in the Diabetes Impact Project. Dean Paul Halverson says place matters.
You know, there's over a 14-year difference in life expectancy of a little baby born today in southern Indianapolis, just south of where Lilly headquarters is at, and a baby born in Carmel.
Fairbanks School of Public Health and Eli Lilly are leading the pilot. Halverson says it's unique because it targets specific needs of each neighborhood.
If we can change some things and help them by making a couple of relatively simple changes, it could change their life.
Trawick says when she visits with her neighbors, they tell her about some of the obstacles to better health, like crime.
And a lot of my seniors in my area are always afraid to go outside. you know, with them hiding in their house, they're not getting out getting medical attention, they're not getting out getting exercises.
She says another obstacle is lack of recreation options, especially for children.
They have Washington Park on the south side of 38th Street, but when you have little kids, who's going to send them across 38th Street?
Partners announced the project last spring.
This partnership is significant.
Marion County Public Health Department Director Virginia Kane says the five-year project will identify people with the disease, connect them with care, and support prevention efforts.
We all want to live in a city where your zip code doesn't determine your health. And for the people living in these three neighborhoods, the goal of this is to make a real difference that is felt today and by future generations.
Alma Trawick is excited to spread the word.
Many times there's programs and people don't know about it. And so I'm glad that I'm involved in this because now I know everybody in my area is going to know about it because I'm going to tell them about it.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. St. Joseph County, Indiana Habitat for Humanity is counting down for the start of the 35th annual Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Works Project during the last week of August. The nonprofit hosted a Kids' Day Tuesday for those moving into new homes to mingle with future neighbors. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Aguiano has more.
Jim Williams is the president and CEO of St. Joseph County Habitat for Humanity. He stands under a pavilion at Pottawatomie Park in South Bend as he tries to avoid a collision with kids present for Kids Day. He says events like this help build a sense of community for those in the program.
Habitat has always been more than just building a house. The thing that's so motivating for us at Habitat is when we can see these families and realize, you know what, this is going to make such a difference in their life, not just for 1 year, but for 10, 20, 30 years.
Williams says one of the biggest misconceptions St. Joe Habitat frequently faces is that they give their houses out for free. He says nothing could be further from the truth. Williams says Habitat is unique because of sweat equity, or the 250 hours of volunteer work homeowners put in with Habitat, either working at the rehab store or helping others build homes in order to qualify for housing. This is after they've been accepted through an initial paper application. Prospective homeowners also have to take classes on topics that range from finances to general home maintenance. Williams says volunteer work with Habitat makes the program more personal for those in it and gives them pride in their work.
You know, you can talk about statistics, you can talk about building a physical house, but when you look into the eyes of these kids and you look at a parent describing how they felt when they were accepted into the program and you see tears coming down their cheeks,
Cleora Taylor from South Bend is one of those parents who tears up when she talks about her experience with Habitat.
I will be in a one-story. I'm actually getting to build with Jimmy and Rosalind, so it's going to be an awesome opportunity to be able to be side-by-side with them and build on our house.
She doesn't cry when she's interviewed. She says she started to practice how to keep her cool in front of cameras, since she'll get to work on her house with the former president and first lady. But every now and then, her eyes get big and glossy, and she has to wipe away a tear. This usually happens when she talks about her four kids or how lucky she is to be a part of Habitat. Taylor says she didn't know the program existed until she saw it on TV one day.
And I seen the president, Garth Brooks, and all that on TV, and I was like, whatever family gets those houses is going to be lucky. I'm like, I didn't even know that, you know, something like that even existed.
She says she applied for the program with a couple of her friends and began to worry after they received letters that their applications had been denied.
I'm not understanding, like, I'm not getting denied, I'm getting accepted. So I kind of like, my friend's like, oh, we got denial letters. And I'm like, well, I haven't gotten anything in the mail.
She says when she did find out, she was at work and completely broke down. Taylor says all of the support from St. Joe Habitat, like the classes she's had to take over the course of a year, have been worth it. She says high rent affected what she's been able to provide for her children.
I'm looking forward to being able to not put them in a situation that I was in coming up, having to pay for college or get student loans, or, you know, I want them to have a different opportunities than I did and show them that it's a different way.
Taylor giggles when the conversation circles back to the Carters being part of the build on her house.
Have you practiced what you're going to tell the president?
No! I've definitely been working out twice a day because I feel like it's going to be like super national. I cannot be on TV looking a mess. I mean, even though I'm going to have a hard hat on.
More than 30 homes will be available through St. Joseph Habitat for Humanity in Mishawaka and South Bend this year. For more information regarding the program or the 2018 Carter Works Project, please visit hfhsjc.org. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. As Bloomington leaders look toward the city's future, they're trying to make getting around easier for residents, regardless of how they're getting to places. A proposed transportation plan puts an emphasis on making streets more pedestrian-friendly and includes major changes to Kirkwood Avenue. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, leaders are looking to other Indiana cities for ideas.
Kirkwood Avenue is often considered the heart of Bloomington. It's where both visitors and locals spend a lot of time and money. But a new transportation plan reimagines the iconic street into what's called a shared street.
People are able to use the middle space as well, and then there's no curbs.
That's Sagar Onta with Tool Design Group, a firm the city hired to help with its draft transportation plan. The long-range vision focuses on expanding multimodal transportation. On Kirkwood, that means doing away with curbs and giving pedestrians priority. While cars would still be allowed, they would travel at slower speeds. Onta says pedestrians could use the center of the pavement, which could also facilitate street festivals. Several people spoke during a meeting Thursday night, saying they like the idea. But resident Margaret Clements worries the proposal doesn't take into account people who have to drive.
And I'm concerned about access in and around Bloomington by car for the elderly. I'm very concerned about the safety as we narrow the streets.
Another controversial proposal involves converting College, Walnut, Atwater, and 3rd Streets from one-way to two-way roads. Onta says while some may be resistant to such a big change, it's good for businesses.
The slower the traffic is, the more streetscape that is improved, it is going to help the economic vitality of downtown.
Some residents express concerns about parking being limited if they rework the roads and traffic getting backed up because of delivery trucks. But Greg Alexander goes downtown with his kids and thinks the two-way streets could be safer.
Switching that to two ways, the drivers will have to look both ways. That'll slow stuff down. That's all I need. If you just slow traffic down, it won't kill my kids.
Several other Indiana cities have considered similar changes in recent years. South Bend invested about $20 million in what's called the Smart Streets Initiative. Jitin Kane is deputy director of public works for this city. He says there's been about $100 million in new investment downtown since the project started.
The one-way streets were really highways through downtown, and what that did is it created a way to evacuate the downtown, and we're trying to create a more connected system or more pedestrian-friendly system.
In addition to converting about 8 miles of one-way streets to two ways, the city narrowed roads, reduced speeds, and changed the way pedestrians and cyclists use the roadway. There are now protected bike lanes and a separate designated area for walkers and runners.
One of the things we're trying to do with this Smart Streets initiative is to create a more vibrant downtown. And when we say vibrant, we're trying to make sure that all modes of transportation have equal access.
While leaders view the project as a success, there were hiccups along the way. The construction created congestion downtown, and the new traffic patterns themselves resulted in backups at points. Some residents just couldn't be won over, arguing the investment could have been better spent. They're all lessons Bloomington leaders could learn from as they create a vision for their city's future. By many accounts, the downtown is already thriving. Resident Dave Dirk is one of several who question whether changes to spur economic development are best for Bloomington.
If you drive up from Kirkwood on College, on Walnut, and then turn around coming College, it's almost totally developed. So I don't think that's an issue.
The city will make changes to its plan based on resident feedback. It could go before the Plan Commission for approval as early as September. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Spiros Batistados of South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority.
About his view about it, we have Spiros Batistados. He's the executive director and president and CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. And as always, Spiros, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
It's great to be here, Chris. Good to see you.
Well, if you will, fill us in, you've had a chance to take a look at what the consultants from Texas have had to present to the RDA board. I know they were supposed to have voted on it, I think, today and receiving it from the consultants. Tell us what you know about the plan, how feasible a convention center in Lake County really could be.
Well, I mean, I think if any rational individual takes the time to do a couple of things. One, to take a look at the wealth of experience, professionalism, integrity, knowledge that is possessed by CSL, which is Convention and Sports Leisure out of both Texas and Minnesota. They've got a couple of different offices. Mm-hmm. These guys know their stuff, and they have helped and done this in hundreds of communities. It was interesting, I thought, yesterday when they made the point that they've said no before, that nobody benefits from, you know, coming in and going, I absolutely build it and they will come, and then the thing becomes an albatross or a failure. So they've said no quite a bit. They know their business, and they've provided the Lake County Council and the Lake County Commissioners through the RDA an exceptional study. Their metrics are on point. Their analysis, the way it was done. Again, even if you want to be an ardent naysayer about the need for a convention center, if you look at the report, you read the report, and you have the ability to reason, I don't know anyone who could look at that and not say that we got our money's worth as far as real professionals telling us what our mm-hmm. options are. Having said that, I'm personally, I'm thrilled. It came back better than I even expected. I mean, I've been advocating for this project, and our organization has said we need a municipally financed convention center, which we do not have in Lake County, and we need to be in control of our own destination. You mentioned at the opening of the show, Chris, that the Radisson Hotel is down, the theater's coming down, the Twin Towers. This is a private businessman who has single-handedly changed the landscape of the community and the drivers of tourism and hospitality. And that's his prerogative to do so. I've long maintained that a convention center would have complemented the Radisson project as it existed and will complement any future investment made anywhere in the county as we move ahead. So I was very pleased to see the report. I thought the numbers were even more optimistic than we were, and we've got 30-year knowledge of the market. Mm-hmm. So we're pleased, and I was very pleased with the reception we got by the elected officials yesterday. They were convinced, I believe, that this was a fair, unbiased, countywide study, and if you look at the top five sites – Maryville's represented, Hobart's represented, Gary and Ham and Highland. So I think that it's incumbent on everyone now to have intelligent, rational conversation about the need to generate $400 million over the next 20 years. Do we want to see an increase of $22, $25 million in local taxes? Do we want to see jobs created at that building and as well as others around it? Do we want to start reclaiming restaurants that might be vacant or building new ones or seeing new investment? That all you have to do is look at downtown Indianapolis and see what that building and the two arenas have done. Mm-hmm. So this is a long-term, game-changing economic opportunity to continue to build and diversify our economy. And that's what we're here to do. So sorry for the long-winded answer, but there it is.
Well, thank you for that. And we also mentioned, too, that, of course, the details of what we know right now about the plan is spelled out in both of the articles in the Times and in the Post-Tribune that they put out. They've gone through and broken it down based, I imagine, from the executive summary that the Convention Sports and Leisure International has put together, and I'm sure it was brought up at presentation before all of the officials yesterday, to explain what, at least in basics, is the idea about the feasibility of a convention center in Lake County. Talks about things about, as you mentioned, the contribution of $400 million in economic activity over the next 20 years to Northwest Indiana, in particular to Lake County. We're talking about I guess the idea of a 145,000 square foot complex, I've kind of called it, I guess, just the convention center and all of the other facilities, I guess, that will go with it. And I know that because we had the reliability of not only the convention facilities there at the Radisson, but the hotel itself and all of the other accompanying businesses in the area, they're recommending, of course, the same sort of setup, I guess, wherever it may be, too, I would imagine.
Well, a couple of things I'd like to clarify you on, because there are important distinctions in the business. The Radisson was never a convention center.
Right.
Whenever a hotelier builds some meeting space attached to their hotel, it's a conference space. That space was outgrown by the Indiana Association market and in a number of other pieces of business really at around 2000, 2001. We haven't seen Indiana Association of Cities and Towns. We haven't seen Indiana Association of Realtors, bankers, law. I mean, all the Indiana Association business really stopped coming as then – Indianapolis started growing. Fort Wayne was growing. We just got stagnant. So again, if we look back and look at what if we'd made this investment 20 years ago and continued to have, we would have had more hotels. We would have had nicer hotels. We would have had more full service hotels. Those are the things that follow. Secondly, in this convention center of 145,000 square foot for the convention center building alone, about 75,000 will be what we call front of house. 75,000 will be back of house. So whatever the final square footage you want to have to sell and hold events in, you need to mirror that with load-in bays, storage facilities, all those kinds of things. So there's a one-to-one ratio. So we're talking about building a 75,000 square foot usable hall, breakout rooms, ballroom, that kind of stuff. Then it needs 75,000 square foot back of house.
Yeah.
Sorry. And then the study is very accurate, and we don't need – I mean, quite frankly, you don't need a study to look at and realize why you have to have a headquarters hotel. The Genesis Center was built in the mid-70s in downtown Gary with no adjacent really hotel property. And then shortly after that, the Sheraton closed. You can't sell these things if you don't have attached full-service hotels. So I don't think that should be a surprise to anyone who's ever been to any kind of a meeting. You know, if you want to walk out of your hotel and walk to the convention center. And so the study points out the need to have other ancillary hotels around it, restaurants, attractions. So we've got a great example already here of a building that has no economic viability because it doesn't have any tourism infrastructure around it.
Yeah. Let's take a look at these four locations that the articles mention, the study mentions in much more detail, I'm sure, that seem to be at the top of the list. I'm sure there are probably several others that they have brought up in the report as well, too. They talk about four sites, I guess, in particular, and they mention, as we've mentioned, Merivale, Hobart. We also have Hammond Highland and Gary. We talk here about the possibility of a potential site there, the former Century Mall, which is located on US 30, not far from, along 30 and Broadway, I guess is the best way to describe it here in Merivale. Is that area, from what your opinion is?
I've long really championed the Century Mall site.
Mm-hmm.
I also really like, and I had a conversation with a councilman yesterday, this idea of this Hammond Highland Oxbow site, for a variety of reasons, I think offers us more of what the customer wants, being closer to Chicago. I think that the city of Hammond has some financing tools in its toolbox that no other city has. I think that when you look at the product and the opportunity to build that entertainment district that could be anchored to the north by Purdue Cal or Purdue Northwest and go all the way south to Highland downtown and that whole Kennedy Avenue spine for future development, there are a lot of choices here. And I think what I've talked to people about, Chris, is that these top five sites truly allow four municipalities to call in developers, investors, look at their TIF districts, look at what money they may have, and really step up and compete for this project. And that's what I'm hoping will come from this is that you know, would love to see Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. and the town of Merrillville competing and bringing assets and driving a better investment for this project. And that's what I think those five sites do. And I think that the Century Mall site, to go back to your question there, is the one that gets us out of the ground the quickest. Mm-hmm. You know, tearing down part of the Burlington Coat Factory building, building the you know, the building that is needed. You have outlots there. You have hotels around it. You have all the restaurants and retail in Merrillville and Hobart. We could be hosting conventions in under 2 years at that site, because all of the parking, the electric, I mean, everything's done.
Well, I was going to mention the parking. Yeah, it's, I mean, a huge parking lot to begin with because it was a mall.
Right. It's an adaptive reuse, and we're not cutting into green space, or we're not trying to do a whole lot of other stuff. So every site in there, of course, the Radisson site has great attributes. The Majestic site uses the lake, which is one of the things I think that we have that no other community in the state, clearly south of us, has access to. So I think we have to have a meaningful, thoughtful conversation about, and when I say we, all of the policy people, all of the local electeds, the business community, I think we all have to get around the table and say, which site offers us the way to tell our story, to build an economy, to put people back to work, to create investment for the next 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. And so each one of those sites has something that the other one doesn't. And I think that just shows, again, the kind of integrity and professionalism brought to us by CSL.
You mentioned about the fact that the local leaders had a chance to get a little preview of this at a workshop that was held Tuesday, and had some members of the county council there, as well as all three of the commissioners, checking out what this presentation is all about and the feasibility plan. As you recall, did they have anything they may have said to remark to you, perhaps, or at the meeting about what they saw? It's a little early to tell whether they're going to support it or not, but they're the ones that are going to have to decide if there's going to be some way to finance it.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the questions was, and one of our, you know, a lot of time was spent with the group saying, look, let's focus on the economic justification of the project. Let's talk about what it means to the community as far as jobs and spending and all of the things that go with it. We've got plenty of time. And again, I go back, if those four municipalities are really competing for this, what we may need from the county might be a fraction of what they're thinking might be needed today. Mm-hmm. So if the county council thinks, oh my goodness, I've got to, you know, come up with $60 million today, well, that may not be the case. You know, one of these municipalities may cobble together, you know, 40 of it, and then we're having a much different conversation. So I think that the questions that were asked yesterday were thoughtful. A few of them were about the metrics and the kind of how the mechanics of the study worked. You know, I don't remember every question, but there was a lot of nodding of heads, a lot of understanding of the economic need. And I think 150 pages of any study, it takes some time for people to digest and be thoughtful, even on a 10-page executive summary. You don't just get it, read it, and all of a sudden you're completely knowledgeable about the topic.
And I understand, too, that as far as the entire presentation is concerned, the county council will all get together and get to hear it again sometime next month. At least that's the plan. So those who attended yesterday's session got a preview in a way, and then they'll get the full presentation all together and get to hear it then later.
I really think the RDA did a great job yesterday. The council and commissioner's appointment, Randy Palmateer, made sure that, you know, it got in front of them. It was released immediately to the public. It was done in a way so that nobody could say, oh, there's some back room. You know, here it is. About the time that those people were seeing it, it was live on a number of different outlets. It had been distributed. My board got it at almost simultaneously to them. So, you know, we want to take out any of these speculations. And, you know, this is a legitimate, important economic development project. You layer it along with the train. You look at what's going on the Marquette plan. You take a look at what this could mean. You take a look at the other headline today, $4 million more for Lear Corporation. That's great headlines. So, you know, we understand the need for Hammond and all of our communities to have just as much at a traditional kind of manufacturing economy, as well as improving a service economy, as well as what's going on at Oxbow. All of these things help us grow a better community. We've never advocated, as the South Shore Convention Bureau, don't invest in anything but tourism. Well, of course not. We want U.S. Steel to be profitable. We want BP to refine a ton of oil. And we can all live together. And I think when you look at the headlines and see what's going on, it's a very, very good time to be in this community.
We just have about a minute left or so now. And Sparrows, if you will, give us a clue, at least in your thoughts, as to what the next steps are going to be now.
Let me make this clear. We are not – the RDA is driving this. This is the RDA's project. They commissioned the study. They're on point here. We are, in essence, technical experts. What I think could be the next step is that we continue to brief the rest of the council and commissioners. I think that there's going to have to be a lot of communication with state officials, in case there's something that's needed with an existing law that maybe needs to be amended or tweaked in order for the financing, to happen as we start putting things together. So I think that the most important thing that could happen, Chris, is avoiding the rush to judgment. And the second most important thing that could happen is the avoidance of the very traditional zip code wars that go on in Lake County. If it's not in my city, we're not going to do it. No, you know what? Let's not play that game. Let's realize that our economy doesn't see city borders. Our economy, we may have people that live in one municipality, work in another. And I don't know the time we have left, but I always joke and say my eye doctor's in Whiting. My gym is in Schererville. I live in St. John. My butcher, is in Dyer. Whatever it is, we don't do all of our business in one city, and we shouldn't think that way anymore. And I think that's going to be important for people to remember.
Spiros Bostatos is the present CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. He was one of those present for the workshop, and the people from CSL came in to explain the feasibility plan, at least the executive summary, and the 140-some page full study is now in the hands of people that are going to have it, or they will be getting it pretty soon and have a chance to mull it over and work on it to be sure. Thank you for stopping by and giving us your thoughts on this and what you've seen and heard from the presentation the other day.
Well, and since you gave me a bottle of water, I think I probably made out with the better end of the deal than my thoughts were of value. So I'll just take my bottle of water and be thankful.
Well, we do appreciate it for that. Thank you very much.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.